Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Who would have thought the quinoa, the ancient plant that has been a major crop in the Andes for centuries, would get caught up in a fight over patents, seed banks, and genome mapping? Quinoa has become a popular food in the United States. It's also been described as a superfood that could help reduce worldwide hunger because it's loaded with nutrition. But Bolivia and other Andean countries are reluctant to give up their control over their quinoa seeds. Our guest, Lisa Hamilton, writes about this struggle over food sovereignty and food security in the May edition of Harper's in an article titled The Quinoa Quarrel. It's a collaboration between Harper's and Fern, and that's the Food and Environment Reporting Network. And we asked Lisa Hamilton to join us on Radio Times. And nice to have you with us on the show.
Good morning, Marty.
How are you?
I'm doing okay.
That's good. Where does the quinoa, and I have to say I had some last night, I guess in preparation for today's interview, but where does the quinoa that we eat in the United States, where does that come from?
The lion's share of it comes from the Andes, as you said. It originated there. It was domesticated there thousands of years ago. And still to this day, I don't know, 95% of the world's quinoa is grown there. And a majority of that is grown in Bolivia. I agree, it's surprising that this food that, you know, you get in a salad here, or, you know, make instead of rice, it was surprising even to me to find that there's such a conflict behind it.
Indeed, and it's a fascinating conflict that raises a whole host of questions. Help us understand, though, its nutritious value. And it's almost, I mean, to describe it as a superfood doesn't seem like an exaggeration.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that was the first thing that grabbed my attention when I started looking at this topic, was learning that quinoa is more than sort of the next food fad, you know, the next blue-green algae or pomegranate juice. It truly is a superfood in the literal sense of the word. It has the nutritional element. It also has this agricultural resiliency. In terms of nutrition, it has calcium, vitamin E, essential fatty acids, iron, and then above all of those, it's the only plant food in the world that offers a complete protein. So nutritionally, in a way, it's on par with milk. But really sort of the miracle of it is that at the same time as being very nutritious, quinoa is incredibly resilient. It doesn't mind drought or cold or even salty soils. So there are a growing number of people out there who see it as this potential tool in solving one of the big conundrums of the uncertain future we're facing, which is how are we going to feed all these people in a world that's increasingly challenging for agriculture.
Take us to this part of the Andes where you went and you talked to a lot of people to sort of understand the complexity of food security and also this notion of food seniority, sovereignty, I should say. Maybe it is seniority. Take us there and I guess describe what this area looks like and what the quinoa fields look like as well.
Quinoa is native to a place called the Altiplano, which is the Andean Plateau, a high plain which at its lowest points is 11,000 feet above sea level. So it's a whole sort of different world from Philadelphia, to say the least. The soil is poor up there. The sun is blazing. The air is thin and dry. And there are these bone-chilling winds throughout the year and frost about half the year. So it's sort of a picture of adverse growing conditions in terms of agriculture. But this is where the vast majority of quinoa still grows. So in order to be grown outside of this place, you know, you would think that you just transplant this plant down to Iowa or California and it would just boom. But in fact, that's not true. It needs to be bred to deal with what we would think of as more hospitable conditions. When standing on the Altiplano, looking, you know, with the mountains in the background, seeing a field of quinoa where the plants are, from a couple feet high to even 5 feet high, bright red, bright yellow, bright green when they're ripe. It's clear
Beautiful.
That the plant really makes sense in that place. It's at home. It grows right up to the edge of salt flats that are sort of a major tourist attraction in this area.
What's so interesting is that the Bolivian government wants to control the quinoa seed, and obviously if there are efforts to try to transplant it somewhere else, we've got this tug of war over this this genome.
Mm-hmm. It's true. As I said, in order for this plant to grow outside of the Altiplano, it needs to be bred, and in order to be, and I'm not talking about genetic engineering. This is just plain old plant breeding, mating one plant with another to produce an offspring with a new set of genes. The issue is that the raw material of that process is, genetics, and those are contained within seeds. Bolivia and the other Andean countries, but largely Bolivia, control the vast majority of quinoa seeds, or as the industry calls it, germplasm. Because of a very checkered history of intellectual property exchanges around the world that have been happening over the past 20 years or so, Bolivia has no interest in sharing that germplasm. And it's made it so that all of a sudden there is this conflict between plant breeders around the world who want to bring quinoa sort of down to sea level for the poor of the world, a conflict between them and really the poor of Bolivia, who are trying to hold on to their native plant.
Is it about that you use the word sovereignty in your article? I mean, is it about culture? As you said, even what happened to the potato as a kind of cautionary tale as we talk about quinoa. But is it this sort of sense of pride that this is our food that we grow in this forbidding region of the world, in our country, and we do not want to let it go?
Yeah, absolutely. For people in Bolivia, this is about much more than just agricultural policy. Particularly for the indigenous people who make up the vast majority of the population on the Altiplano, quinoa, and particularly protecting quinoa seed, is really about preserving their identity. Mm-hmm. And quinoa, this plant that their ancestors domesticated, is giving them a chance, really a rare chance on the Altiplano, to make a decent living. They don't want to give that up. It's not just some sort of political or economic chest puffing. For people on the Altiplano, this conflict is really tied in with establishing and maintaining their own self-reliance after, 500 years of one form of subjugation or another. I think of one quinoa farmer I met while I was in Bolivia researching this story, a man named Herman Nina, who goes by the name Tunupa.
Right.
He was out there in the field harvesting his crop with a weed whacker. He would go through with his weed whacker and hack the plant down right at the base while his helpers gathered up the plants to dry and then be threshed. And he stopped for a break to talk with me. And there he stood, surrounded, by these 4-foot-tall red quinoa plants in an otherwise totally sparse environment. And he had his weed whacker over his shoulder, sort of like a rifle almost. And he said, this isn't about food security. This is about food sovereignty. As you said, by which he meant, this isn't about providing food security for the world. This is about food sovereignty for the people of Bolivia.
I was reading an article about what is happening in this part of Bolivia, and the article said that farmers are making some money off of quinoa, but they're while they might be making more money, they're eating less quinoa because they're exporting it to America and other parts of the world. Did you find that, Lisa, in your travels there?
You know, I found that every person I spoke with in Bolivia about that topic had a different view. A lot of it had to do with where a person lives. You know, if you are a quinoa farmer on the Altiplano, you're probably eating just as much quinoa as you ever have, which is on a daily basis but in small portions. Long ago, diets there switched over to including a lot more rice and pasta for starch, replacing quinoa on a certain level, long before it became a valuable crop. But I think it is true on a certain level that the poorer classes in Bolivia, in the cities, or people who are not growing quinoa themselves, it has become less available. Mm. But it's a complicated issue, and I think it's a good lesson for those of us thinking about this conflict from far away, you know, from thousands of miles away and thousands of feet down in elevation even, that the reality on the ground is a lot more complex than any newspaper or magazine article can address, frankly. You know, I'm happy with the article that I wrote for Harper's, but there still is so much more information and so much more discussion
sure.
to be had.
Sure. We're about a minute away from our first break here, but as you do describe, there's a seed bank in Bolivia, but that there could be some risks, I guess, associated with having this ancient seed all sort of, in a sense, held in one place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of consequences to what's called seed sovereignty, this not sharing of seed with the international community. And one of the consequences is that the onus of protecting that seed for the future lies solely on the country that owns it without the help of the international community that often has greater resources to truly protect seed. In Bolivia, there was a real disaster some years ago where the quinoa gene bank was lost in a fire. 1,800 varieties of quinoa were lost in a day.
Wow.
And it was only by chance that it was recovered. But had that chance not been there,
they would have been lost.
It would have been lost. Yeah. So there are real consequences to not drawing on the strengths of the international community to protect germplasm.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Lisa Hamilton, her piece in the May edition of Harper's Magazine is titled The Quinoa Quarrel, Who Owns the World's Greatest Superfood? And it's a collaboration between Harper's and Fern, and that's the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Yes, we're talking about quinoa. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Juan Institute supports WHYY. They are a graduate school offering acupuncture and herbal medicine in Glenside and in Hahnemann Hospital. They have both faculty and student clinics. Details at woninstitute.edu.
Delaware's resident ensemble players presents the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Wit by Margaret Edson, April 24th through May 10th. Faced with a life-threatening illness, Vivian Baring discovers through the pokes and prods of modern medicine that her rigid view of the world may be threatened by her own need for human compassion. Wit is a powerful, profound, and often funny look at what really matters most in life. 302-831-2204 or DelawareRep.org. The Rep supports WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, and you've probably never heard this song before.
That song translates into When I Wake Up Tomorrow, but other than that, I don't know what he's saying, and I kind of like not knowing.
New sounds from Norway, next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
supporting WHYY, the 2014 Lincoln MKX with 305 horsepower combined with an EPA estimated rating of 26 mpg highway. Actual mileage will vary. More details about Lincoln MKX at Lincoln.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. The popularity of quinoa has sparked a debate over who has rights to the ancient seeds. They're currently controlled by Bolivia and some other Andean countries. And our guest Lisa Hamilton explores these issues in her story in the May edition of Harper's called The Quinoa Quarrel. She also wrote a book called Deeply Rooted, Unconventional Farmers in the Age of Agribusiness. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Lisa, you interview so many interesting people that are all sort of pieces of this story about quinoa, including a guy, he's at Brigham Young University, a guy named Rick Jelen, and he has plans for quinoa, but those plans are currently, I guess, on hold.
Yeah, you know, Rick got involved with quinoa from a sort of spiritual standpoint. He is a Mormon and deeply part of the community within Brigham Young University there that has a humanitarian motivation. And he has seen sort of the miracle of quinoa, this new nutrition combined with agricultural resilience, and saw it as an opportunity to bring this sort of powerful food tool to struggling communities throughout the world in this era of climate change. And he is working on the genetic level, mapping the quinoa genome, trying to facilitate better breeding of quinoa, but he finds himself stuck because the germplasm, the seed that they need to breed it, is not available. And so he's turned to a pretty interesting solution, which is looking to the wild relatives of quinoa for that genetic material. It's a much slower process of breeding a new kind of quinoa when you're incorporating a wild relative, but it is still possible, and that's what he's working on at BYU.
And where is he finding that wild relative?
It's interesting. Probably most people here listening on the radio have encountered the wild relatives of quinoa with or without knowing it. There's a plant called lamb's quarter that's very common throughout the United States, grows as a weed on a lot of farms. It's eaten in some cuisines in the South. Well, lamb's quarter is a not-too-distant relative of quinoa. So what Rick has done is go travel throughout the United States where he can collect as much seed as he wants because there are no restrictions, looking for these wild relatives in sort of the most adverse places he can find. He collected one specimen in Galveston Bay in Texas, growing in an estuary, so essentially in salt water. Proof that, you know, the plant was going to be able to confer a salt tolerance that was really desirable.
And that's very important in understanding the quinoa's ability to, I guess, to adapt to these rather harsh environments. It seems to tolerate high levels of salt.
Exactly, exactly. But one of the challenges in bringing quinoa down from the Andes is that it hasn't really ever had to deal with heat and with the pests, insects and diseases, that are more common in more fertile environments. There aren't a lot of insect pests and diseases up in the Andes, so that's sort of the first line of defense that is needed. So finding wild relatives in places like Maine or in Texas mean those plants are going to be able to help with things like heat tolerance and dealing with insects, sort of a familiarity with the insects and diseases of lush places.
We have a comment from our question, actually, from Richard from Wilmington, Delaware. So can American farmers obtain this seed?
There is some quinoa already grown in the United States, and there's a plant breeder at Washington State University named Kevin Murphy who is spearheading the American effort to actually breed viable commercial varieties of quinoa. And it is available. In my experience, it's just not at the same level of quality and grain size that Bolivian quinoa is. And the truth is it may never be. Bolivians really will contend that quinoa grown in the Altiplano, and especially in the southern Altiplano, where they grow something called quinoa real, royal quinoa, simply cannot be attained without the specific conditions of the Altiplano. And that may be true. I think the way that you see this conflict really comes as a result of what you're sort of wanting from quinoa. You know, there are a lot of farmers who just want to get their hands on some seed, and that's understandable. There are a lot of food sovereignty advocates, even within the United States, who see any criticism of Bolivia for holding on to their seed and protecting it as just a misunderstanding of this whole global situation. I mean, I think at the end of the day, this article really is not just about quinoa. It's about these conflicts that we increasingly face around genetic resources. Seeds and the genes that they contain have always been valuable, but they are becoming essential as we face an era of climate change and increasing population and the need to adapt our food plants more rapidly than ever before to deal with these changing circumstances.
And based on your reporting and your research on this article, I mean, if Bolivia was willing to give up these seeds and it could be adapted to other parts of the world, would it, do you think, truly affect the kind of hunger that faces so much of the worldwide population?
You know, it's a good question. I think an interesting element of adaptation beyond just agricultural adaptation is cultural adaptation. I spoke with plant breeders throughout the world in Morocco, Malawi, Pakistan, and they all said a similar thing, which was that they were having some success in breeding the plant to their climates, even with the limited genetic resources that were available to them. But they were having a hard time getting people to eat it. People saw the value in growing quinoa as an export crop, certainly, because there's such a market for it in the United States and in Europe, you know, countries that have a lot of money to spend. Even within urban centers in their country, in Marrakesh, for instance. But farmers themselves, presumably the people that are the rural poor, people who this crop is meant to benefit, were not eating it immediately. So alongside their breeding programs, all of these plant breeders had sort of introduction programs of trying to get people to see the value of this plant. For themselves, not just, you know, as a crop to sell.
Sure. And that's I'm sorry. Let me just quickly reintroduce you here. That's Lisa Hamilton, and we're talking about a piece that's in the May edition of Harper's Magazine. It's called "The Quinoa Quarrel: Who Owns the World's Greatest Superfood?" It's a collaboration between Harper's and Fern, and that's the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Lisa Hamilton is a writer, a photographer. She focuses on food, agriculture, and rural communities. We do have some calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cowain. Let me just toss something else at you, Lisa, and then we'll get to our callers. One of the things that you write in this piece in Harper's is that, as it stands now, Monsanto is not interested in quinoa. General Mills is not interested in quinoa. Is it because it's just grown on a very small scale as it stands today?
Yeah, I mean, I think it certainly is commanding a high price on the world market, but still the world market for it is only a fraction of what there is for something like soybeans or corn. Those have always been the staple and really the focus of companies like Monsanto. One of the researchers who works with Rick Jelen, Jeff Maughan, formerly worked for Monsanto, and so he had a pretty candid view of their potential interest. And he said, you know, if it gets to be big and valuable enough, he thinks they would jump in and apply the same principles that they have to other crops, to quinoa. But for the time being, he was, you know, begging and pleading to get some research funding from them, but they just didn't really see enough value. But I think that that brings up an interesting point that we haven't touched on very much, which is that there is a reason why the Bolivian government, the Bolivian people, are loath to share their quinoa seed, and that is because of the sort of intellectual property climate that has pervaded the seed industry for the past 20 years. For sort of all of the time before the 20th century, going back in history to the beginning of agriculture, seeds were part of the commons. And nobody really even thought of owning them. They've always been valuable. In fact, in a story that I love to illustrate this is that during World War II, when the German armies would conquer new territory, often they were followed by state-supported scientists who were there expressly to gather up the new territory's resources of diverse crop seeds. So this is, you know, seeds and genetic resources are this natural wealth and always have been. But it wasn't until really the 20th century that anyone thought that he or she or community could own seeds and by owning them restrict other people from using them. That took place in Bolivia in sort of technicolor in the 1990s when a quinoa that had made it to the United States there was a patent related to quinoa, and the Bolivian people were horrified, and that coincided with a closing of the doors to Bolivia. They said, if seed is no longer in the commons, then we are going to hold on to what we have. It's a very tricky element of ownership, is that intellectual property is that it acts as a sort of trump card. To use a plant breeding term, it acts sort of as a dominant trait. As soon as someone is allowed to take seeds out of the common and own them, then everyone has to own their plants because the common becomes a place that's only sort of to be mined for private possession. So even if you don't believe in ownership of seeds, you have to stake your claim so that other people can't exploit what you're holding.
Yeah, and what a collision of cultures there. Let's get Gary from Malvern to join our conversation. Gary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I see this issue with quinoa, but you brought up a really good point, because if it wasn't for all the genetic modification stuff and Monsanto and other companies trying to develop a monopoly of our food supply, this wouldn't be such an issue. But what I see actually over history is an equation with the situation with the potato as with quinoa, because the potato is a high-altitude crop from Peru, and a food of the indigenous peoples. And during a time when Europe was really in a bad way, famine-wise, and could have really had a major famine, potatoes came along. Mm-hmm. And now what happened was that only one or two types of potato developed for the area, for Europe.
Gary, let me just jump in, only because we have a couple of more minutes before we have to say goodbye to our guest. But you raise a really interesting parallel between the potato, if I can say that, and the quinoa, and some interesting history there. Let me give Lisa a chance to respond to the point that you raised, Gary. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Lisa, you want to take that?
Yeah, well, I think it's a really important point of And there are a lot of important points embodied by the potato, but this one in particular in terms of history and the timing of the introduction. The potato sort of came down from the Andes really back in the days of the conquistadors. Mm-hmm. That was when it suddenly made its way out of South America and to the rest of the world. There weren't issues of ownership there. There weren't issues of intellectual property. The potato became a valuable food throughout the world. As the caller said, it became vital for Europe. And at this point, most people in the world probably don't even know where it came from. Had quinoa had a different history and had it come down from the Andes hundreds of years ago, we wouldn't have the conflict that we have today, and it might be as essential and vital a food as rice or corn, for that matter. It could be that large seed companies might be really interested in it and might be funding research on it. But the point is that it's just now coming down from the Andes during an era where intellectual property rights are really the dominant mindset in the seed industry, and that has totally shaped its modern history.
So how do you think this will end? Will the indigenous people of Bolivia continue to grow quinoa and the rest of the world struggle to try to figure out how to get their hands on it?
No, I think that Bolivia is under an incredible amount of pressure to share their seed, and I think they have they certainly have international backing in protecting it. They're signatories of the Convention on Biological Diversity, which protects their right to hold on to their seed. I think that they are starting to move toward realizing that there's benefit in leading the world in growing quinoa and helping the rest of the world to grow it. At the same time, they're no country bumpkins. They are very savvy about the economic side of this. And so at the same time that I think they're beginning to share their germplasm, they are making sure that Bolivian quinoa is recognized as different and better than the rest of the world's quinoa that is to come. My understanding is that they are working on a designation of origin with quinoa the way that champagne comes only from a certain region in France.
Oh, that's very smart.
Yeah, and so on. So at the same time that they may be opening their doors, they are trying to make sure that there will always be a protection for the true quinoa, as they see it.
Well, Lisa Hamilton, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about this quinoa quarrel, as you describe in the May edition of Harper's Magazine. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And the piece is titled "The Quinoa Quarrel, Who Owns the World's Greatest Superfood?" And her article is a collaboration between Harper's and Fern, and that's the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Do stay with us. We've got a guest waiting in the wings. We're going to be talking about squirrels after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Camp Hill Special School with day and residential options is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Camp Hill's curriculum includes music, art, drama, the sciences, life and social skills development, animal husbandry, and horticulture. Camp Hill Special School is hosting an open house at their Chester County campus on Wednesday, May 14th at 9 a.m. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
Washington goes wireless?
While I'm out in the district, I can bring up my phone and vote that way. And so I think it's just a way to bring Congress into the 21st century.
So via the internet, we can Skype, we can talk remotely to relatives, conduct job interviews, and even hear from Edward Snowden. So why not politics? Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents John Batiste and Stay Human Friday, April 25th in Perelman Theater. Artistic Director-at-Large of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, Batiste has ignited the New York jazz scene with his interactive live performances. Batiste and his musical collective Stay Human create music that connects with the next generation while staying true to the roots of jazz. Tickets for John Batiste and Stay Human available at KimmelCenter.org.
This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowain. I never paid much attention to squirrels until I got a bird feeder and I saw how clever and tenacious and voracious they are. One was so obsessed with eating the bird seed yesterday that he or she wrestled my bird feeder to the ground. So it's clear I'm losing my battle with squirrels. I was pleasantly surprised to read an interview in the New York Times recently with Bill Adler, author of a book called Outwitting Squirrels. It's subtitled 101 Cunning Stratagems to Reduce Dramatically the Egregious Misappropriation of Seed from Your Bird Feeder by Squirrels. It is now in its third edition, and Bill Adler joins us on Radio Times. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks, Marty. It's great to be here.
So a third edition means you've gotten a lot of mileage out of these squirrels.
Yes, or maybe I haven't exactly figured out the solution yet.
Well, I have to say, I'm beginning to develop a kind of grudging respect for squirrels because of their sheer tenacity. Do you have that at all?
In the beginning, I was so anti-squirrel, and that was I was driven. But now, I maybe they like me a little more, too, but I'm beginning to respect them and understand them more and appreciate them for being kind of cute, but don't tell anyone I said that.
I certainly won't. Actually, let me give out the phone number to our listeners, and it's 1-888-477-9499. You can also email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coaim. So when did your battle with squirrels begin?
Oh, it began when I moved to Washington back in the late 1980s, and I was living in an apartment by myself. I'm originally from New York City. I wanted to have a pet, but the building didn't allow cats or dogs, and a friend of mine said, well, get a bird feeder. You'll attract all sorts of birds. But since I was from New York City, I said, well, why do I want to attract pigeons? Because that was the only kind of bird I knew.
Of course.
And my friend said, no, there'll be blue jays and cardinals and other birds that are cute. So I did. I put my feeder out there, and I put bird seed in there, and the next day I got a squirrel. I mean, not just at the feeder, but in the feeder. And so I would do all sorts of things, bang on the windows and take the flash of my camera and flash, and the squirrel would simply not go away. So I did the only sensible thing a writer could do, which is to write a book about squirrels.
Now in its third edition. But does that mean that there were no birds at your feeder because the squirrel was just dominating the feeder?
The squirrels were a little intimidated by the birds. Occasionally a brave bird would come by, but it was really squirrel land. I mean, the squirrel was not just at the feeder, it was in the feeder. It was like a lounge chair restaurant kind of combination. And worse than that, but I would be on my phone. I lived in a small apartment, and I'd be talking to somebody. I was single at the time, or maybe setting up a date or doing business, and I would say, get the blank out of here, talking to the squirrel, of course, in a very loud voice, but the person on the phone thought I was talking to them, and it totally ruined my social life. So I really had to do something about squirrels.
Yeah, all the squirrels' fault. So how many bird feeders have you had over the years?
Oh, you know, I have never even counted. I have probably contributed, I mean, I hate to say this, to the misuse of plastic more than anybody on the planet. My feeders have done collisions with the ground, and the squirrels have destroyed them and scratched them. I think seriously I've gone through over 50.
Wow. And so have you come up with one or discovered the one that is good for the birds but keeps the squirrels away?
It really depends on where the feeder is. There's no perfect feeder. And part of the reason is that squirrels have nothing to do all day long but to try and break into our feeders. I mean, they don't pay taxes, they don't go to work, they don't go out for dinner. Well, they do go out for dinner.
Yes, they do, apparently.
But they're just absolutely tenacious. So some people will, one of my favorite kinds of feeders, if you have a yard, is the kind with the big dome that goes over it, because the squirrels have a hard time with that, but they have a hard time, not an impossible time, because eventually they will land on the dome so many times they'll scratch it and make it a rough surface. sitting upside down, if you can visualize this, with their little back paws holding onto the dome and curling around underneath with their head in the feeder below with the seed, and they look perfectly happy doing that.
I mean, you got to give them a lot of credit, don't you think?
I really do. I mean, I would say that they're very well evolved towards breaking into our feeders, but of course they aren't. I mean, they're just good at being squirrels, and that involves finding food and getting at food, and I really do admire them. I mean, the birds have it easy. The birds just come, and they land, and they can fly. The squirrels have to break through all of the things that we are trying to do to keep them away, and sometimes in moments of weakness, I think to myself, well, why do we prefer the birds over the squirrels?
Good question. And you say in your book that you have a fondness for blue jays, which have often been described as the kind of squirrels of birds because they can be so aggressive about food.
They are. I mean, the blue jay, I like the blue jays because they're very smart birds, and they're fun to look at, and they have personalities. But yes, they can also be rather noisy and
bossy,
bullying towards other birds.
We have a Facebook from Michelle using stratagem, one of the words in the subtitle to your book, saying, use sunflower seeds. Squirrels don't like it. Did you find that to be true, Bill?
Sunflower, they're not that crazy about, but on the other hand, you limit the number of birds that you'll attract with just one kind of seed. So, yeah, you can pick particular seeds like sunflowers that squirrels are not that happy with, but that does cause other problems.
Let me get, looks like John from Camden, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. We have come across what I think was the solution to the squirrel bird feeder. We have when we lived in the suburbs, we don't anymore. We had a long post on top of which was a platform. Okay, maybe 6 foot high post. And on top of that was a platform. Down over the post, before we put the platform on, we pulled old milk plastic milk containers. You slid them at the top and the bottom and pull several of them down over the post. And then you put the platform with the bird seed on it. We ground up all our old everything that was left over food-wise and mixed it with bird seed. And the birds can come. And the squirrels have not found a way to claw their way up over those plastic milk containers. They cannot get a purchase on it with their claws. So it was perfect.
Well, I'm intrigued by your creativity. Let me see what Bill Adler has to say. What do you think, Bill?
Oh, I think John's solution is a great one. I love the homemade barriers the most, I think, because we kind of look at the feeder and figure out, well, all right, here's what the squirrel does. And here's how I can stop the squirrel. But the milk cartons are great because they're not so rigid. I mean, I think there's some flexibility so the squirrels really can't grab a hold and have a stable platform. So I like it.
John, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. We're talking about what to do about squirrels and bird feeders. And again, Bill Adler, our guest, his book, Outwitting Squirrels, now in its third edition, if you can believe that, and it's subtitled 101 Cunning Stratagems to Reduce Dramatically the Egregious Misappropriation of Seed from Your Bird Feeder by Squirrels. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Speaking of milk bottles, Bill, you use or recommend or have tried Perrier bottles also. How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, Perrier, because if we're going to be spending money on trying to outwit squirrels, we might as well spend a lot of money. So you can arrange them kind of, you can do a number of different things with them. You can arrange them kind of, squirrels need to have a place to take off from if your bird feeder is up high. So you can use them as a way to prevent squirrels from having a launching platform.
Clever. What about grease? I tried some Vaseline just to see if I could keep them off my pole, but that certainly didn't stop them.
It can be a temporary measure while you're trying to think of other things to do, but I think in the long run, you're right, Marty, it's not going to work. I mean, For a little while, yes, but the grease will wear off and the squirrels will find some other place, or the squirrels will, by their climbing, push the grease away.
You say squirrels eat about 24 ounces of nuts over the period of a week? That's a lot.
Yeah, it really is. And in fact, I've switched to nuts on my own new feeder now, new feeder being a really accurate term because I know it won't last long. And
the newest one, right?
Pardon?
The newest one, right?
The newest, yes. The newest one, temporary. And because I'm curious about what neighborhood birds I have prefer nuts, and the squirrels are going through about that quantity of nuts a week, and I'm going to have to switch back to regular bird feed because I don't want to be feeding the squirrels premium food.
And that's pretty expensive as well. But it sounds like, Lisa, division of eating habits, so at least temporarily the squirrels are eating the nuts and the birds are eating the bird seed?
Yes. In fact, that's another strategy that you can use, is squirrels happen to like to eat. I mean, that's their main mission all day long. But they like to eat easy. I mean, it's sort of like human beings when we're really, really hungry, we open the fridge and we tend to pull out what's in front because it's right there. So if you have a feeder for squirrels with that's got no barriers, no protections, and then a separate bird feeder, the squirrels will have a tendency to go towards the easier food to get to.
Let me get Becky from New Hope to join our conversation. Hi, Becky. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Hi
there.
I just wanted to ask real quick about those the bird feeders that start spinning when a squirrel lands on them. How effective are they?
Have you looked at that?
You know, I haven't used them, and they look like lots of fun. So I'm hoping to find out how well they work personally soon.
Becky, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We have Ellen from Haddonfield who has a question from, looks like, Facebook or Twitter. How can I prevent them from digging up bulbs? Have you gotten that far in your battle with squirrels?
I have, and I am sorry to say that is going to be one of the most difficult things to stop. And the reason is squirrels frequently forget where they buried individual nuts. So what they do in the spring, when they're hungriest, is they dig everywhere and anywhere. The only thing that you might be able to do that has some chance of being effective is to put out nuts that are easy for them to get to. Again, they go for the easiest. And in the springtime, it's actually, we think of the spring as being a great time for rejuvenation and lots of food coming out, but it's actually the hardest time for squirrels because they've exhausted the winter nuts that they've buried. New plants really haven't begun to produce food for them, so they're looking for anything that they can get. So putting out nuts or other food for squirrels in the spring is the best thing you can do to save for bulbs.
Let me see what David from Bryn Mawr has to say. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we have
Hi.
You, David? Hi. Go ahead, David. You're on the air.
Bryn Mawr, not Bryn Mawr.
Oh, sorry. Bryn Mawr.
Bryn Mawr, yes. I have a feeder in my backyard, a large tray, mounted on top of a five-foot, four-by-four post. Over the post, I inserted a piece of stovepipe or galvanized heater pipe, and on top of that, I put an upside-down flower pot, large plastic flower pot, cut the top out, cut the bottom out, rather, so it would fit over the post, and no more problems with squirrels.
That's great. Send us a picture of it, David. We'd like to see what that looks like. What do you think, Bill Adler?
I think David's homemade solution sounds great. I really like them. I like to see pictures of them, too. They're really fun.
You, in your book, talk about using, at some point in your battle with squirrels, something called Nixalite. What is that?
Yes, Nixalite is really popular in cities. You know, pigeons like to roost on eaves, and pigeons are not so great for buildings. So this Nixalite is this spiky material. It's not harmful to pigeons or other animals, but it's very spiny and pointy and other adjectives with the Y at the end. So it creates a barrier for squirrels. They'll be able to go around it because it's not very big, but they won't be able to launch from any place that's got Nixalite. So it's one... It's very easy to find. It's one option for creating another barrier.
We have a comment from Virginia from Wilmington. How can she deal with people who feed squirrels and then attract them to the neighborhood? Bill, do you have a solution for that?
Well, I presume she wants legal solutions.
Yes, legal solutions. We are on the air. Yes, indeed.
So it's tough. I mean, people do like squirrels. I mean, I understand that now after doing this book for a while. It's going to be a tough... I don't think you'll be able to stop that. People communicate and enjoy nature in different ways.
I can't get him on the air because we're almost out of time here. Chris from Wilmington says he has an uncle who rigged up a remote control device that spun the squirrels off his feeder. Just another example of people's tenacity, I guess, and creativity.
Yes. I mean, it's something you have to just keep doing and thinking of new ways to outwit them.
And is there an extreme, in your research, we're almost out of time here, but in your research, one of the more sort of extreme stratagems to use against a squirrel?
Yes, remote-controlled water cannons. They seem to work temporarily, but you really have to be monitoring the situation all the time.
Well, it's a full-time job. Bill Adler, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, you're welcome, Marty. It's been fun.
And it's been fun for us as well. And again, the book is Outwitting Squirrels, 101 Cunning Stratagems to Reduce Dramatically the Egregious Misappropriation of Seed from Your Bird Feeder by Squirrels. He's a president of Adler and Robin Books, that's a literary agency and a book packaging company. He's also the author of, over a dozen books as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. In fact, go to our Facebook page. We already started a series of conversations, both about bird feeders and squirrels, and also about quinoa. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.